Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to start today's episode with a look at something that happened very recently in American history, and that is the controversy taking place in American football, not what the rest of the world calls football. That's the controversy taking place in American football regarding players taking a knee in protest during the national anthem.
I refuse. Wait, are you supposed to take a knee? No, you're not supposed to take a knee. Mm-hmm. It's disrespectful to take a knee. In fact, the NFL, I believe, just came out with new rules that require players contractually to stand for the national anthem. But as you say, Ben, yes, it was an act of defiance, a way of standing up or taking a knee, rather, for their particular cause célèbre. Mm-hmm. Is that okay, Casey?
That was great.
Oh, and that's our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Who is, in fact, on the case.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Ben, and you are?
I'm Noel.
Oh, and that makes this ridiculous history. Yeah, we are not the, it's no secret that you and I are not diehard NFL fans, but like many people in this country and in other countries, we were fascinated by this story, by this process of protest and counter-protest. And Noel, as you pointed out just a second ago, the NFL did in May of 2018 ban the practice of taking a knee, although this is a tremendously controversial ban.
Yeah, I think it's being appealed or picketed or, you know, protested in some way by the union, the players union, I believe. Because come on, man. Like, if you can't protest as a multimillionaire overpaid sports figure, you know, what does that say for the rest of us?
And what does it say about free speech as well?
Exactly. But we're talking about not this exactly, kind of. It's weird. It's part of the story, but we're talking about kind of the opposite of this, which is using sports as propaganda.
Right. I would say that we're talking about a larger context because this specific event in modern history provides an excellent point of comparison to the earlier events that I think surprised both of us when we began digging into this. And sporting events on an international scale have long functioned as acts of propaganda. You know, iconic moments in history occurred at the Olympics, for instance, right?
Absolutely. And what is the Olympics if not a chance for various countries to achieve perhaps not global dominance and hegemony, but at least dominance on the field of sport,
right?
A faux battle.
Yeah. And we see it in the World Cup. We see it in the World Series. We see it in the Super Bowl. And today's episode involves a tremendously important political event that took place on a soccer field. We have to go into some political context, I think, first, right?
I think we do, Ben. It's true. So we're talking about Germany, right? And the second half of the 1930s, the Nazi Party that had taken over Germany was really, really, really becoming quite aggressive, weren't they, Ben? In 1935, they publicly announced that they were going to rearm their military, which flew in the face of a little something called the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I. Isn't that right, Ben?
That is correct, Noel. And we've talked a little bit in the past about the enormous cost Germany bore as a result of World War I. And this had dangerous effects on their economy, and it's one of the factors that allowed the very aggressive, expansionist Nazi regime to come into power.
That's right.
And at the time, other people, other countries and heads of state couldn't agree on what the proper unified response to this aggressive German government should be. The question was, should we contain the Nazi Party and Germany? Should we openly combat them, or should we attempt to, you know, appease them, make nice?
Let's run with that word, Ben. Let's make a whole system out of this.
Yeah,
a policy. We'll call it appeasement.
There we go.
How about that?
In a burst of creativity.
Well, but you can understand why. I mean, people were shell-shocked from the havoc that was wreaked by World War I all across Europe. I mean, that was no fun. It was utter devastation in many parts of the country. And the Treaty of Versailles, even the Allies kind of realized, people on the ground at least from what I've read, that the Treaty of Versailles wasn't particularly fair to a lot of the countries that it involved, especially Germany, because under the treaty, they were limited to having 100,000 strong military. But again, in 35, after they'd been kind of amassing weaponry all these years, they got the confidence under Hitler to come out and say, yo, we are building up our military again. Boo on your treaty. We could care less.
Mm-hmm.
And they escalated that. 36, they occupied the Rhineland, which is a region, a small region in the middle of the country, also totally against the Treaty of Versailles.
Yes, and this appeasement policy may sound strange to us today because we have the benefit of knowing what happened after this policy was in place. But the appeasement policy is often pointed out as the worst decision that Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain ever made. But there were other British prime ministers who followed the same policy, including Ramsay MacDonald and Stanley Baldwin. This wasn't just made for Germany. It also was applied to Italy, which was under the control of a fascist regime at
That's
the time.
Right.
And it lasted from 1935 to 1939. Our story today takes place during that time. It takes place in 1938 at a soccer game.
It's true. And just to backtrack ever so slightly, to go back into appeasement, every time the Nazis did these kind of brash moves, like occupying the Rhineland, in the year of our story, they annexed Austria.
Right.
And they actually, like, did a coup d'etat within their Nazi, already pretty strong Nazi party within Austria, and Austria being Hitler's boyhood home.
Right. We're going to spend a lot of time in this episode going from the specific events to the larger context. So before we get to the famous event that occurred in May 14th, 1938, let's go back earlier in the year to April, where we saw another precedent set, an example of protest through sport.
Yeah, the one we kind of alluded to at the top of the show. Because like I said a minute ago, it was in 1938 that Germany really went hard in the paint and totally annexed Austria, as I said, overthrew the government in an effort to combine the two countries in an event they refer to as the Anschluss.
Yeah.
And Austria had a pretty ballin', pun totally intended, soccer team, football team, headed up by a guy by the name of Matthias Sindler.
Yeah.
Or Schindler, I've heard. I think it's Sindler. There's no S-C-H. It's S-I-N-D-E-L-A-R.
Yeah.
And Ben, he had a really cool nickname, didn't he?
Yeah, it was the Paperman, or Der Paperin. Sindelar, S-I-N-D-E-L-A-R, was known as the Mozart of football as well. I don't know if you saw that one. He played as the center forward for the Austria national team that was known as the Wonder Team. And he captained the 1934 World Cup. This guy is a football superstar. And this game that occurs on April 3rd in 1938 was meant to celebrate what Germany was calling, get this, Austria's coming home to the Reich.
Come on home to the Reich,
Come
Austria.
On home to the Reich.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the problem. Sindler hated the Nazis.
Predictably, yeah.
I mean, they totally came into his country, took it over, tried to change everything about his way of life, including trying to smush his football club in with the German football club. That sucked, by the way. Germany was not good at soccer. Can I call it soccer? I'm just going to call it soccer.
Yeah, just call it soccer, Noel. As a matter of fact, we have a fun firebomb to throw for you ridiculous historians if you are football or soccer fans.
A factual Molotov cocktail?
It might be a bit incendiary for some people. I found this article in The Atlantic called Why Americans Call Soccer Soccer. By Uri Friedman, it's a British term.
That makes
sense.
It's
not a U.S. term.
Okay.
And we here in the States picked it up from England. The word soccer originated in England, fell into disuse there, and became dominant in the States. And there are some people who have studied this who found what they did is they looked at the frequency with which the words football and soccer appeared in American and British news outlets dating back to 1900. Soccer was a recognized term for the game we're describing for the first half of the 20th century, but it wasn't widely used until after World War II, when it became interchangeable with the phrase football and sometimes used together, soccer football.
Okay, but I'm an American. I'm an American, and I'm proud of it. So I call hitting that ball with you hit your foot with the ball game, I'm going to call it soccer.
So
just as not to confuse, you know, because I don't want to say American football. That sounds ridiculous. So
you have
just
to say it in a British accent.
Exactly.
If you say American football.
Although the fact the Brits have been dominant in the sport since the very beginning.
And I want to sew this up real quick because I'm sure this is going to interest several of you ridiculous historians, especially if you've had an argument with one of your friends across the pond about this. It traces back to World War II. Most likely American troops stationed in the UK during the war came back and started using that phrase, and that led to a backlash against the word in Britain, and now this word has completely immigrated to the U.S.
Isn't that funny? You still haven't given me the etymology. It's just like, is it about the socks? The knee socks, the fact that you're socking the ball around with your foots?
It's a shortening of association footballer.
That's stupid.
So soccer.
That's the worst possible answer.
But you can't go in and expect a language to conform
that's
to
true.
What you as an individual
I'm not mad
of,
at you, Ben. Know? I didn't mean that to come off like it was your fault that the origin of soccer is so dull. But I'm disappointed.
I think it's fascinating.
It is fascinating, Ben. You know what else is fascinating?
Yeah, back to Sindler.
Let's do it. So again, super salty about the Nazis coming in and invading his home turf and trying to, you know, jam up his soccer club. And so they, this game in question in, what do we say, April of 1938?
It's April 3rd, 1938.
That's right. It's meant to be, on paper at least, a celebration of the historical legacy of the Austrian soccer club.
And the last match that the team would have as an independent Austrian team.
Before it gets smushed in with the far inferior German club.
So they begin protesting the moment they hit the field.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Well, what I had seen in an amazing documentary from the BBC called Fascism and Football was that it was very clear that the Austrians had been told to lose.
Yeah, to throw the game.
To throw the match.
To show the symbolic or propagandistic importance of aligning with Germany.
That's right. And just to one quick aside, one quote that I think is so amazing from this documentary, Fascism in Football, rather, you can find the whole thing on YouTube and it's just great, is the idea that sports were such a powerful tool for propaganda because when you win, you win. And you can't, like, no one can accuse you of lying, because if you win and are dominant in a sport, then that's just before everyone's very eyes. You are the clear, you are the winner. You won and you play by the rules.
It's what we today would refer to as optics.
Optics,
and
exactly.
PR. And so the star player of Austria's team, Sindelar.
That's right.
Refuses to go along with this plan. He says, I am not going to pay obeisance to this invading power, and furthermore, I'm not going to cheapen the most important thing in my life.
Well, and the funny thing is, too, like, yes, you're absolutely right. He definitely did not go along with it, and that he did not look like he was trying very hard. Mm-hmm. He made it very clear that he was just kind of farting along very lacklusterly, right?
Right.
I think he even was, like, shaking his head in disdain, kind of.
And refused to wear the uniforms they were supposed to wear, their traditional white and black. They replaced it with, on Sindelar's orders, more or less, the Austrians played in red, white, red outfits, the national flags colors.
Yikes.
And yeah, like you're saying, the audience knew something was up because it seemed like they just weren't trying. They were just farting around until, what, the last 20 minutes?
Yeah, and then Sindler, the paper man, scored one of two goals.
And Carl Sesta got the second one.
Who I think was his bestie. I think they were like really, really close. And yeah, they totally humiliated the Nazis. Apparently, kind of did one of those like end zone kind of cocky,
yeah,
cock of the walk kind of dances right in front of, like, can you imagine the scene, Ben?
The scene,
stands, yeah, full of Nazi officials,
high senior Nazi dignitaries, and they celebrated extravagantly. They owned the moment because they really had publicly humiliated these officials. And it's, we don't have solid historical proof of this, so this is entirely speculation on my part, but I would not be surprised if some of those pro-Nazi forces, knowing in theory the outcome of the game, had decided to gamble on it a bit.
Oh, absolutely.
So they were out money, but more importantly, they were out public credibility.
Oh, absolutely. And here's the thing. As you might imagine, Sindler was made persona non grata at that point. He was declared, in their internal Gestapo memos on him that declared him pro-Jewish, among other death sentence worthy distinctions.
Like a social democrat.
That's it. That's
and
right.
So he... within the year, or within a year after these events, he was dead at the age of 35.
Under the most suspicious circumstances. Mm-hmm. I think he had been out partying that night and gambling in a coffee shop that he was a part owner of, or the guy that talks about it, his buddy in this documentary, referred to it as his coffee shop. I'm not sure if that was just a translation thing or if it was just like the place where they would all hang out.
Right.
But they were gambling, playing cards, a lot of money was on the table, and a lot of drinking, and then he went back with his girlfriend to her apartment, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. One thing led to another. They go to sleep and they never wake up because they died of carbon. Actually, she ended up in a coma that she never recovered from.
Right.
And he died in his sleep of carbon monoxide poisoning.
Which was recorded as an accident.
Why?
Because.
This is super cool.
Yeah, because according to Egon Ulbrich, a lifelong friend of Sindelar.
He's the guy I was talking about that was talking about the gambling night.
Yeah, yeah. He says in the documentary, and then also in an article called Football Fascism and England's Nazi Salute on the BBC by Jonathan Duffy, he says that the truth of the story was that a local official was bribed to record Sindelar's death as an accident, ensuring that he would receive a state funeral. Because, and we have a great quote from Ulbrich about this, because Nazis had particular rules about this.
That's right. This is the quote. According to the Nazi rules, a person who had been murdered or who has committed suicide cannot be given a grave of honor. So we had to do something to ensure that the criminal element involved in his death was removed. That's wild, man.
And it continued escalating. Yeah, the Germans were very, very serious about the value of propaganda. And from their perspective, this sort of insolence could not stand.
Mm-mm.
So it's pretty obvious that he was murdered.
No doubt. And did we mention the fact that for a while, as the Nazis rose to power, maybe this is obvious to everybody but me, they kind of masked their awful racist ways?
Totally. But
they didn't reveal the full nature of their final solution or their idea of, you know, pulling up the Jews and the Roma people or any of the just horrible, horrible racist leanings until a good bit later. And this was still during that time where obviously they meant business, but the true nature of their evil was not on full display yet.
Well, it was also in that time, this is an unfortunate and ugly truth, in that time, anti-Semitism was widespread. We know
just
that,
in the gen pop.
Yeah, just like throughout Europe, definitely. Also clearly in the U.S. And the same prejudices applied to Roma as well and other quote-unquote, you know, subversive elements or what they would call deviants. So these people, this group, had existed throughout various countries in Europe for centuries, right? And the shocking racism, the anti-Semitism, the ironclad and puritanical attitudes about sex were normal. If you read a German textbook about the concept of living space for the German people, it's not that different from many other textbooks of the time that also argued the innate superiority of certain ethnic groups. And it might change during the country. So people didn't know. I think the point you're making that's really important is people did not know that there was genocide on the horizon. Privately, members of the Nazi regime were already thinking of ways to forcibly deport elements of the population they didn't approve of.
That's right.
And they were trying to figure out where to put them. Like, would it be Madagascar? Would it be some other country? And then eventually, as we know, this led to one of the most horrific occurrences in human history.
Oh, God, and I hate to get political about it, but it feels like when you start reading about the early stages of the Nazi takeover and the kind of rhetoric, that kind of this nationalistic rhetoric, while not overtly racist, very dog whistle racist, sure, in a very similar way that we're experiencing in our country right now. And it scares the crap out of me reading this and thinking about history repeating.
In just multiple countries, right?
Absolutely.
So we've got this context with Sindelar, who now we know was murdered, but originally—
We don't really know. I mean—
Yeah.
But you can't. It couldn't. I
it
mean, come
feels
on.
Feels like he was murdered.
Come on.
You're right. We don't know for sure. We
that
have
dossier,
to be fair.
Those classifications, I mean, that was— Yeah. Everyone says that was a death sentence.
Somebody had their eye on him, and not in a good way. So in this context, we have the precedent for protests, and then we have the precedent for sport events overall, especially football, soccer, whatever you want to call it. We see this as a medium for propagandistic communication. Let's get back to this concept of appeasement. And let's talk a little bit about Neville Chamberlain.
Yeah, and how far this idea of appeasement went in the way it played out on what the Brits refer to as the soccer pitch.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk a lot about media manipulation in the modern day, but it was a known, tried and true technique here in the 1930s as well. So much so that going back to May 1938, the 14th of May, English soccer players traveled to Germany to play the German team in a soccer match.
That's right, but minus their ace in the hole, Sindelar, who was still living at this time.
Yeah.
But he refused. Probably another reason he was blacklisted in the way he was. To add insult to injury, mm-hmm, he refused to play for the new combined Austrian-Germany team, which obviously was just called the German team.
Yeah.
He cited old age, but he was like 35, I think.
Yeah.
And also simultaneously injury. So it was just a bit of a FU to old, you know, Führer. Yeah.
So let's set the scene. Casey, could we have maybe the sound of a crowd at a soccer match? More than 100,000 soccer fans file into Berlin's Olympic Stadium. And the countries, at this point, everybody knows war is escalating. Things are ratcheting up, right?
Big time.
And these countries, Britain and Germany, are still playing nice. They don't trust each other, but they're still going through the motions and the gestures of diplomacy. And swastikas and British flags are flying side by side. The German national anthem is being played over the speakers. But on the field below, if you can imagine this in your mind, fellow historians, something very strange occurs. The German and the British players raise their arms in the infamous Nazi salute, the Heil.
Right? Let's hear the clip.
Cup final enthusiasm prevails in Berlin when England meet Germany on the soccer field. All the courtesies are observed before the start. God Save the King is played. And the English team in white shirts give the Nazi salute during the German national anthem. 115,000 spectators pack the Great Olympic...
All right, so that was newsreel footage from the Associated Press on the day of this infamous event. And it's reported eerily in a matter-of-fact kind of way, but there was a lot of controversy surrounding this game because by this point, if not their full final solution level, complete and utter evilness was on display, people knew that the Nazis were fascists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And
big time.
Yeah, and the British press, despite efforts at media manipulation to make the population pro-appeasement, the British press had had enough.
Absolutely.
People were outraged.
Mm-hmm.
And it was even, there was even more insult to injury because it turned out, despite this gesture on the part of the English team, Adolf Hitler wasn't even at the game. He wasn't present. They were just saluting the idea of Nazis.
No, it's true. In fact, like, I think the very first game he ever attended, or earlier in this story, the Germans lost to, I think it was the Netherlands, or a smaller team that was seen as being less skilled than the German team. So, and he was really irritated about that, so he didn't always make appearances. But no, he was not at this game. And the thing is, the Germans did lose this game. They got their bratwurst handed to them by the Brits, who again, as we said, were pretty damn dominant in the sport. There's an interview in this documentary where the guy's like, yeah, it wasn't really that big of a surprise because pretty much everyone lost to the UK.
Oh, yeah. Can we play that guy's clip? I just love his voice.
To lose to England at that time was nothing unusual because basically everybody lost to the British team at the time. So I think for Hitler, the propaganda effect of that game was a lot more important than everything else.
Right. They were known to be one of the best teams on the planet. They won the game 6-3, 6 England, 3 Germany. And the weird thing about the score is it was somewhat of a footnote because the thing everybody was focusing on was this bizarre attempt at diplomacy. It wasn't spontaneous on the part of the English team.
Oh, no.
Neville Chamberlain had in advance told them to do it. And the from what we understand, the intent of this was to make nice and show that Germany was not considered to be a, quote, pariah state.
That's right.
Despite the fact that they Pac-Man'd up Austria.
And that was also kind of part of Germany's propagandistic way of looking at this, was to show that, hey, we're just like you. We like to play sport, and we like to goose step around in our strange Nazi uniforms and Heil. Wait, something's wrong here.
Showcase our superior Aryan natures. Yeah.
Because I want to go back a little way, just because I think this is a really important point. The real stage setter for Hitler's use of sport in this way was the 1936 Olympics.
The Berlin Olympics.
The Berlin Olympics, which is super interesting because that was like a world stage. Everyone's watching. It's in Berlin. Hitler's there. He used it as an opportunity to showcase, like you said, the efficiency, the militaristic might of the Nazi state. But there was a little kink in Hitler's idea here of showcasing the, you know, might and prowess of the Aryan supremacy or what have you, this mythos he was trying to create. When Jesse Owens, an African-American competitor, won
4 gold medals.
That's right, Ben. 4 gold medals. It was in 100-meter, 200-meter long jump, and 4x100-meter relay race. Just completely in front of God and everyone, crushing that idea. And Hitler was none too pleased.
Right, which is weird because this is such an iconic moment. And, you know, we're going to brag a little bit. Jesse Owens is American, so take that, Nazis.
Indeed.
And do you like how I brag it as if we had anything to do with
it? Sure.
Yeah. But there's an interesting tidbit here because this occurs in August of 1936. August 1st, I think, is the first day of competition. There was a newspaper editor named Robert L. Vann, himself African-American, who was at the scene. And in an article dated to August 4th, 1936, he says, "Wonder of wonders, I saw Herr Adolf Hitler salute the lad. I looked on with a heart which beat proudly as the lad who was crowned king of the 100 meters event got an ovation the like of which I had never heard before. I saw Jesse Owens greeted by the grand chancellor of this country as a brilliant sun peeped out through the clouds. I saw a vast crowd of some 85,000 or 90,000 people stand up and cheer him to the echo." And that is winning hearts and minds, isn't it? I think it's so easy to underestimate the importance that these sorts of events can play in human history.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, because people, I mean, I've seen pieces, whole, you know, papers written about the idea of sports as a religion. People put as much credence in, you know, baseball players and basketball players they do in, you know, God.
Right, like King James, the name for LeBron.
Because
right?
It's a stand-in for our hopes and dreams, you know? Mm-hmm. Even if it's sort of a false dichotomy, it's because you win a soccer game as a country, doesn't really translate in reality to mm-hmm. your might or prowess. It's sort of a microcosmic view of that.
Which is why so many countries spend so much money and time and occasionally so much effort at skullduggery when it comes to winning international sports competitions. I have a thing I'd like your take on, Noel, and you as well, folks. Do you think sport, the concept, just sports games, do you feel like it has taken in the most powerful parts of religion, the most powerful parts of war, and the most powerful parts of economy? I feel like it has.
I think you just answered your own question, Ben. That is a very...
I mean, what do you think, though?
Well, I think it's a very... No, I think that is an astute point, and I think that's absolutely true. And I think we see that, too, with what we opened the show with, the idea of the power that these players have, and when it doesn't jive with the money behind the power or, like, the organizational power behind the scenes, there can be issues. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it involves people getting carbon monoxide poisoned to death in their sleep. Sometimes it involves getting, you know, players being suspended for taking a knee during a national anthem. It's just interesting the way politics and sports can be so intertwined. And I think it all goes back to even earlier than this. This is just probably the biggest, most obvious political example that we have. But to your point, Ben, as far back as the Romans and gladiators and bread and circuses and all that. Sport has always been a powerful tool to manipulate the minds of the people.
And
manipulate maybe is the wrong word. I don't know. What do you think?
I feel like manipulate is a perfect word for this. Also, we have to point out, spoiler alert for World War II, everyone. So tune out if you don't want to get spoiled for this. We have to point out that Chamberlain's and Britain's appeasement policy did not work.
No.
It was just a little more than a year before tensions broke and war began. Correct, Noel?
Yeah, it was September of 1939. The Nazis invaded Poland, and that was just a bridge too far for the Allies. They'd finally had enough. The Germans leagued up with the Soviets to partition Poland into their own separate spheres of influence. And that, my friend, is the story of how World War II really began in earnest. And that's a story for another time.
No, I really enjoyed this episode, Noel, and I hate to close so soon. Hey, what do you say we do a little bit of listener mail?
Huge fan. So the first one I want to pull from a Facebook post that is a really good summary of a myriad of emails we got, Facebook posts, a few people slid into our DMs on Instagram and Facebook.
I loved all of them, by the way. Thanks for writing to us, folks.
No doubt. But they very gingerly shredded us on our pronunciation of a few Philadelphia-isms.
Let's say it together. 3, 2, 1.
School kill. Only there's some people that even quibble with that one, which is why it makes me feel good about it.
So this guy says, Philly.
This guy says, laughing at Ben Bolin and Noel Brown butchering School Kill River. I believe we said some combination of Schuylkill, Schuylkill,
yeah,
whatever. It was wrong. This guy, John C., says it's pronounced school, all caps, dash, kill.
And then you added, John, a smiling, laughing emoji, so we knew that we hadn't fatally offended you.
No, he shredded us with love. And then Ben, as we're wont to do on Ridiculous Historians, posted a delightful response saying, we murdered that pronunciation so hard that this episode counts as true crime.
Badoosh. Hey, thanks for...
and he says, thanks for listening as well for the valuable correction.
I did say it. Thanks for... You just quoted me to
I
myself.
I quoted you to yourself. You did a listener mail. I love it.
That's weird. But check out this thread. This is part of the reason why we love the Ridiculous Historians page, because some of your fellow listeners didn't just point out the correct or accepted pronunciation of this river. Some of them also began bantering back and forth, disagreeing on their own ideas about pronunciation, right?
Big time. And then we had one Oliver C. pop in with a little Georgia-centric thing, saying here in Georgia, they call the old muddy river Okmulgee, Okmulgee. Okmulgee.
And that's spelled O-C-M-U-L-G-E-E.
But the funny thing is, I am from Georgia, and I've always said Okmulgee, and I've heard it pronounced that way, but whatever you say. And then ghee, like clarified butter, Okmulgee. Okay, no, that's right. Okmulgee. That's right. I've heard it that way. And what you would think would be Houston County is actually Houston County.
Which I've noticed. Yeah, that happened to me one time.
Yeah, and then we've got a guy, Rob S., saying, Jersey born and raised here. I always heard it as Schuylkill.
Yeah.
And, drop the L.
And John C. comes back in the thread and says, I don't know if Philadelphians have much room to talk about pronunciation. And he shared this fascinating Washington Post article about the unique Philadelphia accent, which I highly recommend you check out.
Like water ice?
Yeah.
Which is basically like what, like a freeze pop or like kind of Italian ice?
Beach towels.
Beach towels.
Yeah. And we've got a question that I think will interest a lot of us in the audience, and it is this. What are the strangely pronounced places, landmarks, or things in your neck of the woods? Because, for instance, you know, there's Worcester in Massachusetts,
right,
which is completely not pronounced how it sounds, how it's spelled.
There's Peabody in Boston, I believe, or in Massachusetts as well, where it's apparently Peabody.
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 Which is another county or town in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So it takes all kinds.
Let us know. We want to hear, we're not exaggerating, we want to hear the weirdest ones. Who knows? You may save us from you may save us from a future internet post.
You know what? Bring it on, babies.
I love it. So we want to thank you, of course, for journeying with us through this story of sports and protest and appeasement. We want to thank Casey Pegram, and we want to thank Christopher Hasiotis, our research associate, who hipped us to this story.
Do you have a sound effect yet?
Let's see, who else do we think? Oh, Alex Williams, who composed our track, and you, Noel Brown.
Ben.
Yeah, that's
you. I'd like to thank you too, man.
Oh, boy. So stay tuned for our next episode where we delve into a strange story about Heineken, which was actually really inspiring to me.
Heineken? Pabst Blue Ribbon.
All right, yeah. Well, I mean, it takes all beers, you know.
I'm a PBR man.
You are a PBR man.
But you know what? You can't build a hut out of PBR cans.
Oh, well, you could. It just wouldn't be as cool.
No.
What the heck are we talking about, you may be asking yourself. Tune in to find out. In the meantime, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and...
We're about to roll out that Pinterest page.
I think that's...
That old
that's
chestnut.
I'm doing a vision board. I'm keeping it analog, bro. I love
really?
It. Yeah.
You're done.
Yeah.
You're off the net?
No, the vision board, at least, is just, it's a wall in my house,
yeah.
And I just paste up different pictures.
Uh-huh.
I've been going through a laser tag phase.
Oh, cool. Like you're going to go laser tag fashion from here on out? You're going to come to work looking like Tron and stuff?
That would be cool. You in? You interested in this?
Sure, man. I'll try anything, you know, a bunch of times.
Awesome.
In the meantime, if you don't want to do any of that stuff, which you should, you can also join the Facebook group Ridiculous Historians, or you can just send us a good old-fashioned email at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com.